Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. All right. Well, welcome, Lobbying Show listeners. Today is the one-year anniversary of the show. It was 1 year ago that we started the podcast. I should say that we started airing the podcast. It was sometime before that that I started thinking about it, and then we started working on it. And it is really hard to believe that we have done it for a year and that we have done 52 episodes, or 55 episodes. I'm getting hand flashes from the producer, James Wolfe, Wolfie. And so prior to starting the podcast, we really wanted to do this. We wanted to give a voice to lobbyists and government relations people because there wasn't anything out there, a platform to do that. And as we all know, most of what we see and hear in the news doesn't really relate to our day-to-day jobs and how we're perceived and what we do. And so we wanted to give an inside voice to that, to all of us who work in the industry, and to really be a platform where lobbyists and government relations people and PR people and others who work in and around the business can pick up tips, can learn, can hear about what other people are doing, what's going on in the various states, obviously what's going on in Washington, D.C. And we hope we have begun to do that. We very much appreciate the feedback and the ideas that we get from people, and we do get a lot of ideas from people. But when we began the podcast, the beginning of the podcast was overwhelming. The technology, I mean, the discussions we had about the kind of microphone to get was just mind-numbing. I mean, mind-numbing. I mean, and then thinking about what kind of program to use to edit. And I can't tell you the number of editors we have been through. And yes, the show is edited every week for a while. James Wolfe, the producer, Wolfie, would edit the show himself. And that was in addition to our day job as lobbyists. So getting ready was a bit overwhelming. From artwork to the name of the show to who our first guests were going to be. And at some point, we did what I think Stephen Pressfield says in his book, The Art of War. It comes to a point where you just have to launch. And we were probably, we're still making the bread, and we launched while it was still cooking. We really did not know how it was going to turn out. And eventually we figured it out. One of the biggest things we were nervous about is how are we going to get and find and interview a guest every week? And that is getting much easier, in the sense of finding the guests and booking the guests, but finding time to do the interview, finding time to prepare for the interview, there's no getting around that part of it. We had an unwritten rule for ourselves to try to make it for a year. Wolfie thought that we would make it. I think I could say I had my doubts. I thought 52 shows every Monday? Nuts. I can't imagine doing that. And when I say it like that, I still can't imagine it. But we continue on. And part of the reason we continue on is we both really enjoy it. You know, we couldn't do it without each other. Obviously, you couldn't do it without me hosting and interviewing. But I couldn't do it without James here producing it and doing his part of it. So I think we have found it more enjoyable than we thought, much more time consuming than we thought. And we're hoping helpful and what we set out to do, creating that platform and a voice for all of us to come together and hear from one another about what we're doing. So anyways, we will continue on. We have signed up for another year. The listenership is really doing quite well and increasing quite a bit, which I think shows that people are getting something from it and enjoying it. So anyways, we have enjoyed the first year and on to the second. Well, hello, Lobbying Show listeners. We are back at the Dentons headquarters in downtown Washington, D.C. at 19th and K. And today we are very excited to bring you Alex Johnson, the president of InState Partners. We did not know much about InState Partners prior to us getting in touch with Alex, so we are very excited to hear about his career and to learn more about InState Partners. So, Alex, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here. So you, we were talking about prior guests that we have in common. So you know Chris Massey?
That is correct, yes.
Great. Yeah. Any other guests that you are friendly with?
Beth Lowdy, Chris Badgley. There's probably many more. It's a small but large circuit, but you see many of the same people on the road.
So, it's a tight-knit group.
Yep.
So tell us about InState Partners.
So InState Partners is a multi-state firm, and so we work with clients who have multi-state issues, help them navigate the state world, and figure out the right choices for them to make, either from a proactive pushing legislation perspective or from an intelligence perspective, just finding out information regarding their company, their concerns in the states.
And is it typically trying to pass legislation or trying to stop it or just a combination of both?
So it's a combination of both.
Okay.
And InState has a unique background. We are a business unit of Advantage Capital, which is a venture capital company. And they have done a lot of work over the years for about 30 years in sort of public-private partnerships, doing investing, bringing private capital to states. And to do that, you need a team of people to help you advocate for those types of policies. And so over the course of 30 years, Advantage Capital built a network of folks across the country, both their internal team and an external team of lobbyists in each state. And so they had this whole team put together. And as you know, the legislative session takes you for about the first quarter of the year, right? Give or take. And then you've got, I don't want to say downtime. You've got time to plan for next year, but you do have a little bit of that time when you're not going 24/7 in a state capital. And what the folks at Advantage said was, is there a way, we've got this network in place, is there a way we can leverage this for other folks as well? And so they created a business unit called InState, which created about 5 years ago. InState then took on some other clients, mostly doing intelligence work. So you're a client, you need to know the status of tax bills in 20 states. We would provide you weekly updates as to what was going on. Because we had folks, again, internally, externally, on the ground, able and willing to provide that information. I was one of the consultants that they had working with them at the time. And
where were you working?
So I was working for FP1 Strategies, which is a public affairs firm here in town. They were just down the street in DuPont. I think they're across the river in Virginia now.
Okay. You were doing federal work.
I was doing state work.
State work. Okay.
Yep.
In all 50 states or just a few states?
Whatever my clients needed,
quite
frankly. And so so Advantage asked me to come in and run InState because, as they said, we like having clients. We just don't like managing them. And we'd rather somebody do that who has the experience doing so. So
prior to them starting InState, Advantage had a network of lobbyists around the country.
Correct.
And those lobbyists, or Advantage, they were serving the Advantage in-house companies,
correct,
so to speak.
Correct. Yes.
Companies that they had invested in.
Yes.
And companies that needed representation in various states or municipalities.
Yeah, right? And just advocating for good sort of public-private partnerships in the states.
Okay. So you came in to not only manage that, but to bring in outside
clients, correct.
And that's what you've been doing for the past 5 years.
Yep.
And about how many, when you started, how many in-house clients
did Advantage have that you were servicing?
I think there were three at the time.
Okay.
And we've got seven now. And I have a few legacy clients that I've kept with me from prior. So servicing about 10 or 11 clients right now.
Okay. But Advantage is strictly a venture capital firm.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. And do they primarily invest in government tech?
No, they do a lot of it's all about for them driving private capital into places, underserved communities, quite frankly.
Okay.
And creating partnerships with states to do that.
Well, that's so interesting, Alex. I had no idea of the connection to Advantage Partners. So getting back to in-state, are there certain states where recently you've been very active?
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, we do two sides of the coin. We do the proactive pushing of legislation in certain states. Then we do some just intelligence work where we do that everywhere. Mm-hmm. So when we're advocating for clients and pushing legislation, I'm going to be a little more active in those states because I'm going to be there physically or my partners will be there physically. And so our footprint's going to be a little bit deeper, at least for that session or the next session.
Right.
So
what states have you been spending a lot of time in the past year?
This year, a lot of time in Austin, Texas.
What's going on in Austin?
Which was not a terrible place to be.
Yeah.
You know, if we're ranking state capitals, it's going to be higher on the list than some others.
Well, we're going to be there in August, which is not the ideal time to be in Austin. But
sure. Alec, I think, is going to be there.
Alec is there, and we'll be at NCSL in Nashville before that.
Yep. Sure. Another great city. Another great capital.
Yep. So, I haven't been to either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So go ahead. You've been spending time in Austin.
So yeah, we've got a Four Advantage and another partner. We were doing some work around affordable housing.
Okay.
Advantage, again, is an impact investor. So they want to service two bottom lines, their own bottom line, but then another bottom line, which is how do they create impact in communities?
Okay.
And so we were working on an affordable housing bill in Texas. You know, Texas is one of those states. It's every 2 years and it's a big state.
And it's only like 90 or 120 days, right?
And it's a long run up and then a sprint. And unfortunately, we came up short, but it was a great experience.
What were you trying to do? Just to give us a little...
It was, so it's a state tax credit to promote affordable housing.
Okay.
Create more units. Texas is, as I would say to a lot of folks down there, they've got a very pleasant problem is that their economy is doing very well, and people are moving to Texas in droves. The net effect from a housing perspective is drive up the cost of housing, and now you're pushing out of communities people who need to be there. We're talking about first responders. We're talking about teachers, veterans, seniors, folks on a fixed income who now can't afford to live in their communities. And, you know, my point is these people are making – if the market could solve this problem, I would let the market solve the problem because I'm a free market kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a teacher and you're a policeman and you're a fireman, you are sacrificing the opportunity to make money in the marketplace to serve your community. My point is, if they are making that sacrifice, should we then try to help them live in their communities that they would otherwise be priced out of? So you have market failure in this circumstance. Let the market work until there is market failure kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, I think we have an example. This is where the market came up short in servicing.
And because they're sacrificing, government can step in and sacrifice little to help them out.
Right.
I would imagine other markets, San Francisco must be also another one. And
yeah, I mean, it's a question of resources, where we can be and where we think we can move the needle. And California is a tough state to do business in and pass laws. And so for that reason, we have not engaged this year. I mean, you can only do so much every year. And so California was not on the list.
So do you, from January to June, are you spending a lot of time traveling?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of time on airplanes. And
Well, now let's talk a little bit about your career. What was your first government or campaign job?
So I started at the Republican National Committee.
Okay.
When Haley Barbour was the chairman.
Okay.
Great time to be there, early 90s.
Bet. Yep.
You know, I got there in 93. And in 94, Republicans won the House, Senate, and majority governorships. So really tasted nothing but success for the first year and a half of my
And you thought
career.
You were a genius. You're
right,
like,
I was a genius.
right.
So I stayed there for 4 years, and I was in the fundraising shop. So that's, got a whopping $17,000. But as my boss told me, we have great benefits, which when you're 21, you don't really care much about.
So now you were raising money for the RNC, not the Senate side or the House side.
Correct, yeah.
And so for our listeners that have really no idea what that is like, can you just give them a sense of what your responsibilities are and what you do?
Yeah, so at that age, at that time, the internet didn't exist. Email didn't exist.
Yep.
And a lot of the solicitations for money came through the mail. I was an opening the mail kind of guy, looking for checks in the mail.
So direct mail was a big part of it.
Direct mail was a big part of it.
And then events. Events being hosted.
Yeah. So really learning the marketing aspects of attracting new members to the RNC. Mm-hmm. And then once you got them in, trying to move them up the donation ladder, as it were.
Yep. And those new members would come to events that you would have around the country or here in D.C.?
Correct, yeah.
The RNC must have been a fun place to work.
It was a great place to work. You know, it was, I say it's sort of like graduate school for political junkies. I mean, it's really, you had a communication shop and a fundraising shop and political team, and it's a lot of young people and it's a lot of energy, and it was just a really neat time to be there.
And I would imagine the DNC has the same.
Absolutely.
Same, and you guys would probably bump into each other at the local bars
the local
and pubs.
Watering hole.
Softball
Heads,
fields.
Heads was the big big spot on Capitol Hill back then. And, and I was, in fact, there the night that Sonny Bono went up on stage and sang I Got You, Babe.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. True story. It happened. And I was there to witness it. It was pretty cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So you spent 4 years there and then what?
And then I left there and I went to work for Jack Kemp.
Okay.
And Jack was just off of running for vice president at the time.
Okay.
And was keeping his options open should he decide to run for president in 2000. And ultimately, that was when George Bush ran against John McCain on the Republican side. Jack decided not to run in that race. But what a fascinating guy to be around, and I just learned a ton, and it was a great sort of year and a half experience working with Jack.
And I'm sorry, what was he doing at the time?
Again, he had a PAC.
And he was part of a think tank too, wasn't he?
So Empower America was the policy think tank, and this was the Freedom and Free Enterprise PAC, and that was just the political vehicle to get him around. I remember one of the first events we did was for a guy running for Congress in Janesville, Wisconsin, named Paul Ryan.
Jack became a mentor of his, right?
Yes. Paul had worked at Empower America and was running and said, can you come out and do a campaign stop for me? And he did, of course.
That's great. You spent a year and a half there.
Yeah, year and a half there. And then as that was winding down, one of the consultants we had that I worked closely with was running, approached me and said, hey, look, John McCain's going to run for president. And we're putting a team together, and I'd love to have you on the team. And I said, absolutely, would love to do it. And this is 1998 into 99, sort of the end of 98. He was just about to start running in 99, and I was the deputy finance director. And that was an incredible experience. And I think there were three people on the campaign when I was hired, and we didn't even have a campaign manager yet. But we were off raising money, and you know, it was a sort of buy your shoestring ragtag campaign. And I'm running around the country with John McCain, and just a wonderful person to be around and learned a lot. And
he clearly was a bit of a rock star. He had that media.
Yes. That was the energy excitement campaign. I mean,
was that the bus?
That was the Straight Talk Express.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. I remember that going around New Hampshire.
Yep. Spent a lot of time in New Hampshire and elsewhere. But it was just a very unique campaign. And he was just so open, accessible, and wonderful guy to be around. I mean, smart. You could talk about anything, you know. I mean, sports, politics, whatever. I mean, he was really fun to be around.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
And so after that campaign, where'd you head to?
So now we're in the late 90s, early 2000s. If you know, this is internet bubble time. Everybody with a .com was, you know, making $10 million. And so I went out there and said, hey, you know, I've got all these great contacts I've made fundraising.
Yep.
Why don't we see if we can, you know, leverage that to raise money to put together a .com company? And so we did, and, you know, raised $3 million in venture capital and had a company for about a year and a half, 2 years, and just
didn't make it.
Didn't quite make it.
What was the general concept of the company?
So it was a marketing vehicle, and it used personalized greeting cards as a way to market to folks. So you could send a very specifically tailored message to somebody via physical greeting card.
Okay.
And we had some good clients, you know, Capital One and others. We just couldn't get over the hump and eventually ran out of money. So, but it was a good experience. It was great. And I've had an entrepreneurial streak in me, and it was great to sort of to do that. And I think working on campaigns, you have to be entrepreneurial.
Right. That was your first startup.
And this was a manifestation of that in the business world.
So, well, good for you for trying.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Right.
Yeah. So then after that, you had to find a job.
So then I went back to the RNC.
Okay.
And did some consulting there for a little bit.
Okay.
And then in 2002, McCain-Feingold passed. And when that happened, all of the state-run organizations had to leave the RNC, starting in 2003, and DNC. So the RGA was physically located in the RNC. They had to move out because they raised corporate money. Corporate money could not be commingled with personal dollars that the RNC was raising.
Okay.
So you had to have a separation. RGA moved out. A friend of mine was running the Republican Attorney General's Association, moved them out. And he said, the Democrats have this group called the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee. There isn't really one on the Republican side. Would you come help build and run that? And being an entrepreneur and a political guy, I got another startup. And I've got it. I can, you know, I've got a little base of which I can launch this out of. So we've got RAGA, the Attorney General's Association, as a building block. And we looked at what the DLCC was doing and said, let's just do the same thing, go after the same donors, essentially, except for the union folks. And we did that. And once I got that first check, I knew that we were real. And I knew this was going to be something. And but I had to go out there and convince legislators that we could do this, that this existed and was real. And I had to convince corporate folks that this was real. And this should be a good investment of their time and money.
And then what was the money used for?
Money was then used for campaigns. You know, it was for
congressional campaigns.
For state legislative campaigns.
Oh, for state legislative campaigns. Yeah. Okay.
So you've got, of course, 7,000 legislators across the country.
Yep.
But when you think about how many races are important, you can narrow that down to a very, you know, specific number of races.
Right.
In Virginia, they've got an election this November, and the House and Senate are very close. And, you know, at that time, our calculation was, boy, even $100,000 or $200,000 in a key targeted state legislative race could tip the balance. And that's where we try to have the most impact, was trying to find out which races could affect majorities.
In which states. Yep.
And that was a time period, 2002 to 2007 is when I was there. Quite frankly, it was a hard time at the state level for Republicans. I was on the losing end of the scorecard every November as they dwindled. Now, while they were dwindling, our numbers were increasing in the South. And when I started, almost the entire South was run by Democratic legislators. And that's completely flipped.
Yeah.
Today. And it took about 10 years to do it.
So now with these two organizations, the Republican and the Democratic one, could you raise corporate money in those?
Yeah.
You could. Okay.
Yeah.
And about how much money would you raise or spend in an election cycle?
We were probably doing $5 million by the time I left.
Okay.
In a cycle. And, trying to get that into key places and through an independent expenditure or directly giving to the candidate or a caucus.
And those two organizations are still active today?
Yeah. Yeah. They're great. They've grown tremendously. It was fun to be there to launch it. People have done great things with it since I left, but it was a really neat experience.
That's great. And you were there how long?
So I was there 5 years.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a legitimate 50-state organization when I left. And, you know, when I started, it was me and Bill Howell, who was the speaker in Virginia, and Rick Bennett, who was the Senate president in Maine at the time. And we set off on this mission and trying to convince people to build this thing. And
so in your last year, about how many races did you participate in?
Oh, I don't know.
Dozens or 100?
Yeah, dozens.
Dozens.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. It was good. We were having real impact, and that was fun to see. And I still go back and I laugh. And the Indiana speaker, Brian Bosma, today, I remember he was very skeptical about whether this was a good use of his time.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, rightly so, he has limits on what he can spend his time and resources on.
Right.
And So he really vetted us with a lot of people and wanted to make sure that this was worthy of his time. And he went on to become sort of the chairman and was very involved. But we go back and laugh about it today that I needed to twist his arm to get him down to that first meeting. So.
Right. To be able to give him money to have an impact.
Right.
And so they can give money either directly to a campaign or have an independent expenditure?
Yeah. So 50 states, 50 state laws. And we
it's a little different in each one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we just had to figure out how we could most directly have impact. And if that was giving directly into campaigns, we would do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what? What did you do?
So then I said, well, look, I've got all these great corporate relationships that I've built. I've got all these great political relationships that I've built across the country. There's got to be a way to make money doing this.
Yes, got to earn a living somehow.
And so as luck would have it, one of the folks who worked over the DLCC went to Marquette University, as did I.
Okay.
And we knew each other, although we didn't know each other well at school, but we kind of spent some time on the circuit together. And I approached him and I said, hey, why don't we go into business together? There's got to be something we can do to make money here. And so we kicked the idea around until we convinced one client to invest in us. And once that happened, we were real and we went off while we were off to the races.
And so, what'd you call the firm?
Avalanche Advisors.
Okay.
And we called it that because at Marquette University, there's a very famous bar called the Avalanche Super Bar. And so that was sort of our uniting bond was that. So
that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a great experience. It was the Medical Imaging Technology Association was our first client.
Okay.
And they helped launch.
And how long did Avalanche?
So, I mean, I'm still working with Avalanche clients that we have been working with for 10 years.
Okay.
And so he and I still do share a couple clients.
That's, okay.
As I said, when I talk about legacy clients with in-state, those are the folks I'm talking about. And so we went out and you know, it's been really fun to be part of the growth of some of these companies. We started working with Astellas, a pharmaceutical company, in 2008, I believe. And their state government affairs team was, I think, three or four at the time. And they would have a consultants meeting and we could fit, you know, 10 people in a room, tops. And today they're a vast organization. And
yep.
It was fun because they believed in the mission. And they believed in what we were doing. And I mean, the leadership at Astellas believed in state government affairs.
Yep.
And they supported it and they grew it. And it was fun as a consultant to be part of that growth story.
Yep.
Yeah.
And today, do you specialize, you know, do you find yourself doing work in a particular area more than others?
Probably more tech than anything.
Okay.
I've got the big financial services companies. I've got the pharma companies and, you know, we've done insurance and we do everything from ductile iron to Square. We've done work for Lyft and Bird. So we've done the disruptive technologies, but we're looking more and more. We're trying to target our customer base at being technology solutions that help government work more efficiently. So we have worked with a couple of early stage companies to help grow their business. One of those companies is called Payit.
Payit. Okay.
And when we first started working with them, it was the CEO and a handful of technology guys and walking him around a Republican Governors Association meeting and just introducing him to governors and having him sell his story.
What is Payit?
And so Payit does mobile transactions for government. That's at a very high level. But what they're really trying to do is make government work faster, smarter, more connected to their constituents. And so what they do is you want to renew your driver's license on your phone, you can do that.
I don't have to go wait in line for 3 hours?
You don't have to go wait in line. Now, with Real ID, you will probably have to go actually physically in. But
at some point,
they can do is set up a time to make that good use of your time in advance. So at the time they came about, there were states that provided a mobile service, but really it was very early stage technology where you're increasing the size of your screen, you're trying to type in here.
Yeah.
And they have a very interactive platform that, you know, you can scan a barcode, it will access your information and just make it a seamless process for you. So they are now, when we started, they were just the CEO and a handful of folks, and they are now over 120 employees in Kansas City. So it's been really great to be part of that growth story. And those are the types of clients that we really are trying to target.
And so you take them around various states in these organizations where they can meet policy leaders in the various states.
Policy leaders.
Introduce the company and the idea.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we're trying to do that. And we're trying, you know, and our pitch to them is, you know, usually folks, when they get into this business, they have a great idea about making government work more efficiently. And the way it works is that they'll have a board and they'll say, well, my brother-in-law works on the city council in Omaha, and why don't we call him? And then, you know, I've got a cousin who's a legislator in Ohio. And so there's no real rhyme or reason to their growth. It's very organic in that sense.
Yep.
And what we try to do is try to bring some sort of common sense and a plan to it, a strategic plan, where we can say, these are states and or cities that are or more approachable when it comes to technology solutions, or we've got great relationships here. We've got great lobbyists here. Just trying to find that right equation so that we can hopefully shorten their sales cycle, ultimately help them grow faster.
That's great. And then what else besides, you know, DMBs, what else can they help with?
So really, it's a full government platform. And so any sort of transaction that you would have physically
that the constituent
with
may have with state government.
A constituent would have with state government. So that can be income taxes. That can be hunting license. That could be anything you can imagine that you're having to pay for through the state they can handle. And they're diversifying that platform even more today. But that's sort of their launching point. And DMV is usually a place where most people, when they think of it, have a bad experience, a negative experience. And so what they're saying is, let's turn that negative experience into a positive one and say, okay, when I always think of Maryland at DMV, I'm thinking of long lines. I'm thinking of a frustrating experience. I didn't have the right paperwork. I didn't have this. I didn't have that. I was there for 3 hours. Let's turn that frustration into, oh my gosh, I just renewed my driver's license in 15 minutes online.
Yep.
And that's the work they're doing. They're in over 11 states now. They're doing a lot of work in North Carolina, Florida, Kansas. They're a Kansas City-based company. So they're, you know, some growth in the Midwest, but it's exciting. It's great to see their success and be a part of it.
What a great story.
Yeah.
And so for any, you know, we have a lot of people listening in state capitals across the country. If you think Pay It may be something your policy leaders may be interested in, reach out to Alex. He may or may not already have someone on the ground in that state capital, but you can always just hear what they have to say.
Absolutely.
So Alex, what other technology companies, startups are you working with?
Yeah, so we've got a company called Assivilate, and they are based out of Atlanta, Georgia. And what they do is they are in the criminal justice reform space. And specifically what they're doing is they help people as they transition out of prison back into the sort of general population, and they do a number of things. If you've been in prison for any length of time, your entire day has been scheduled out for you. All of a sudden, you're now out in the real world and you've got all this freedom. And that can be a good and bad thing. What they do, number one, is try to organize that life for you. So they have a, you know, platform that they can provide either by phone, tablet, computer, which helps organize your life. Number two, it helps and allows all the different caregivers to share information with each other. And they can do that because the recipient, the owner of the platform, is the person leaving the prison population. And now he can allow his housing coordinator and his parole officer and his work coordinator and everything, all these different aspects of social services can see what he's doing. And he's building up a data profile of where he should be, what he should be doing, and people can track that information. And he's allowing them to track that information. That is critical because between 60 and 70% of people go back into prison for technical violations. If you have been using the Assivilate platform and building a record over a lengthy period of time, should you have some sort of technical...
You miss an appointment,
miss
you do something like that, you can
cetera.
Show everything that you've done.
You now have a data file that you can
come
go
on,
to
give
the
me
judge
a break.
And say, look, I'm on the right track.
I did
I'm
75 things,
things
I was
doing.
Supposed to do. I missed one.
Absolutely.
And how do you spell the company?
It's Assivilate. So A-C-I-V-I-L-A-T-E.
Okay. Yeah. And so you're taking them around to, just like with the other companies,
just
state
like
capitals?
Just like we're taking them into different levels of government, county, state government, and talking to them, talking to folks about how they are changing lives and also making things easier from a administrative perspective, because now you've got administrators have data profiles that they can access to monitor the folks that they are caring for. So we're helping both sides of the equation, the administrative side and the folks leaving the prison population. So it's really neat technology, and we're starting to see some real growth and traction with them as well.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. Again, we're helping change lives, I think, and provide good solutions for government. And that's where we want to be.
Alex, it's been great having you in.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate
it.
It's been fun.
It's been great.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great.
So there it was, Alex Johnson. Hope you enjoyed it. Now remember, if you haven't subscribed, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Google, Spotify, all those places, any of those. Not all of them. Well, I don't know. Could you subscribe at all? Sure. I don't know why you would, but you could. But just subscribe at one of them. That's all we ask. And maybe leave a comment. Send us a note on Twitter. You can do all the above. You can follow us on Twitter at The Lobbying Show. You can sign up for our Monday morning email, Coffee with The Lobbying Show, at our website, lobbyingshow.com. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. So, Alex, great to sit down and talk to you. Thank you for coming on. And until next Monday, everybody have a great week.